Those sounds are familiar to anyone who's traveled around the English countryside. There are various changes run by English bell ringers. You drive out in the Cotswolds or someplace like that and on a Saturday afternoon, and you'll hear every little village church. You'll hear its bells being rung by some bell ringing society from London or someplace, and it's really a fascinating sound indeed. What I'm going to do this morning is tell you a little bit about bells, and then we'll try our hand at doing a little change ringing. We don't have a nice set of tuned English tower bells yet, but we'll do as the British bell ringers often do and practice a little bit with handbells. Some of you may have rung handbells in choirs, but you may have never been introduced to the English sport of change ringing. But first, let me tell you a little bit about bells. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the acoustics of bells. I'm not going to tell you as much about the history as bells and how they work. I'm a physicist. Physicists always are curious about how things work. And you can't take a bell apart, so we study it other ways. And we've been doing some work in our laboratory helping bell manufacturers improve the tone of their bells by understanding how bells work. Bells have really belong to all cultures, I guess. They're almost as old as civilization. They've summoned people to work. They've summoned people to pray. They've been used to summon people to war. They've been used for a variety of different functions. I guess in the Western world, we associate bells mainly with churches, or maybe I should say schools and churches, or locomotive schools and churches. The fine bell up here that rings to tell you when to go to the next class or when to eat, I guess is actually a retired locomotive bell. Bell craftsmen reached its finest development in the Low Countries, in Belgium and the Netherlands, several centuries ago. If you travel around Holland or Belgium these days, and the guide at a church tells you they've got a set of bells that were founded by the Hemenes, why, that's like a musician telling you he's going to play on a Stradivarius violin. The Hemene brothers cast some of the finest bells that have ever been cast back in the 17th century. And in fact, they did for bell casting very much the same thing that the Cremona violin makers did for violin making. Without acoustic spectrometers and the kinds of instruments that we use to study bells, they learned the art of bell casting by trial and error. And they had hundreds of years and several generations to practice. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what makes a bell sound good, what makes a good bell, what makes a not so good bell. This is a diagram of a bell. On the left are the terms that describe the anatomy of the bell, the sound bowl, the lip, the mouth, the waist, the shoulder, and so on. But on the right are the musical terms, or the technical terms, that describe the different partials of bell sound. And each of the arrows points to a particular part of the bell where that partial has its maximum amplitude. The home tone involves vibration of the whole bell, of course, but the sound bowl moves more than other parts of the bell. And so when a bell craftsman is tuning a bell, he may remove metal from a particular place of the bell to raise the pitch of one partial to get them into tune. Large church bells or carillon bells almost always have five tuned partials, sometimes as many as eight, depending upon the craftsman. The strike tone, the tone we hear as the pitch note of the bell, is the fundamental note. That's the second partial. But below that fundamental, there is a hum tone. And I'm sure if you've heard a carillon concert, you're much aware of that hum tone. It persists long after the other sound has died out. It's usually an octave below the fundamental, although some English bells are tuned with the hum tone to be a major sixth below the fundamental. Then there's always a minor third that gives the bell kind of its sort of characteristic mournful sound, and then a fifth, and then an octave, and then there may be a major third above that, and another an octave and a fifth, and other partials above the nominal that are tuned. Well, I think we can leave that one out. That's the physics. That's the equation you see that describes the vibration of a free plate. But these are this is the way the solutions look. If you have a circular free plate, then there are many modes of vibration or different ways that the plate can vibrate. You may have, you may recall from a science course somewhere back a few years, learning about the modes of a violin string. Or if you played a guitar or a violin, of course they're obvious. The string can vibrate as a whole, or it can divide into segments. The next partial above that fundamental mode is one in which the center of the string stands still, essentially, acts as a pivot point, and the two sides of the string vibrate like a teeter-totter. And that note will sound an octave higher than the fundamental. And then there's a third partial in which there are two notes and three segments of a string. So the way you describe the modes of vibration of a string is by how many points on the string stand still, how many nodal points there are. Well, when you go to a two-dimensional object, like a circular plate that you see on this slide, then the nodes are not just little points, but they're lines. So in this first mode, this that I've labeled as a 2-ohm mode, meaning it has two nodal diameters, the two lines drawn here act as pivot points. So if you can imagine these two segments coming up when those two segments are going down. So segments on alternate sides of each of those lines vibrate in opposite directions. So the next mode up has a nodal circle. So the inside is moving one way, the outside is moving the other. And so on. I've sketched the first eight modes of a circular plate. Well, the modes of a bell now are similar. It takes a little imagination to think of a bell as a circular plate, but if you sort of bend it around on itself, it has resemblance to a plate, and indeed when you describe the vibrations of a bell, they are analogous to the corresponding modes in a circular plate. So the hum note now is one which has two nodes which go over the top of the bell. We call them meridional nodes. So alternate sides of this bell will be moving in and out. This side, we're looking at it end on. These two will be moving out, these two will be moving in. Then half a vibration later, these move out and these move in. So it's going from circle to ellipse to circle to ellipse, if you can envision that. And then the other partials of the bell tone come. Each one comes from a separate mode, and these modes have somewhat more complicated configuration. On these diagrams, the dotted lines represent these nodal lines, these regions that seem to stand still, act as kind of pivot points. Well, if you're more familiar with musical notation, I've denoted the first eight, I guess, partials on a musical staff. Just to show that diagram wasn't a figment of imagination, here's a real bell, large carillon bell, with the nodal lines marked on it.
Did you mark it?
A colleague of mine did. What we do when you're studying a bell like that, there are several ways that you can locate the nodal lines. I'll show you some rather striking pictures, no pun intended, later on in the talk, using a rather sophisticated technique we call holography. But another way to do it is just to take a small microphone and move it along the bell and look for the max point of maximum and minimum vibration. Well, if one grouped all these nodes into families. The vertical axis on this graph is frequency. The horizontal axis is the number of nodal meridians, that is, nodes that come across the bell. Then we could group it into families. The one family that has no circular nodes around the bell, one that has one circular node, one that has two, and so on. These are just, this is physicist bookkeeping, I guess this would be the best way to term it. But these kinds of diagrams, this kind of data becomes very, very important to the people who manufacture or tune bells, because that's what they have to go by. Here's a little bit more complicated diagram that gives not only the amplitudes and the frequencies, and gives them in German, sorry, but also shows how fast they decay. I put this on here mainly to illustrate what I mentioned before, that the lowest mode of vibration dies out very slowly. You see, it dies out more slowly, so it persists long after some of the stronger modes have died out, which you certainly are aware of if you listen to the Carolyn concert. And these are the diagrams then that show a bell tuner exactly where he ought to remove metal from the bell in order to tune any of the partials. You see, it's quite a trick, because if you take off metal anywhere along the bell, you're going to change the pitch of all the partials. Mm-hmm. But what you want to do, if say the third partial is a little bit sharp, but the octave is a little bit flat, you've got to just select a place that will raise the third, lower the octave, and bring them all into tune. So it's quite an art. The large bells are cast just a little bit larger than their final profile will be. And since bells usually have some kind of an inscription or some decoration on the outside, the tuning is done on the inside of the bell. They're put into a large bell lathe, and then a little metal is taken off, and then the bell founder tests the various partials again and takes off a little more and tests them again, and so on. Yeah. Hand bells are tuned or are lathed on both the inside and the out. The castings are about twice as thick as the finished bell, and you take metal off both the inside and outside. There are several different ways to ring a bell. We'll be properly British and say three, to be exact. The British bell ringers are very careful to distinguish between tolling and striking and ringing. In a carillon arrangement, the clapper is mechanically swung against the bell. The clapper may be either on the inside or the outside of the bell, but the bell stays stationary. And the clapper is moved by a whole series of levers and pulleys and so on, connected to the carillonier's clavier. Now, if you've ever been up in a... how many of you have ever been up in a tower with and seen the carillon bell, seen the clavier? The clavier looks like a very kind of a primitive piano. You'll see a picture later on taken in the playing cabin of a tower. The batons that are connected to these clappers are long wooden slats with a sort of a rounded, polished end. And the carillonier just goes up and down the keyboard and hits these with his fist. It takes you're swinging maybe a 200-pound clapper in some of the lower bells, so it isn't like moving a small hammer against a piano string or moving a tiny plectrum up on a harpsichord. You've got a lot of metal to move, and although it's very well balanced, still have to strike it quite a blow. So a carillonier, before he plays, he usually puts a little patch of leather at the bottom of his fist, or else he's got off the good calluses. Some of them play without others, and they're literally going up and down, hitting these with the fists. The lower bells are played with a pedal clavier. So he's got some of the low bells can be played either with his fists or with his feet. But he's really very active going up and down that scale with his fists and feet. It's worth seeing. And most carillonaires will allow visitors to come up in the cabin, they usually say, be there 15 minutes before the concert starts if you want to come up with the carillonier and see the action. Of course, the best place to hear the bells is usually down below, a half a block away. You don't hear it as well up to the cabin, but it's kind of fun to watch.
Is there a time lapse between them? I mean, how much of a time lapse is there between when it strikes that and
it depends upon the size of the bell. It takes a little while to clap.
It would seem like
not
too
long.
Yeah.
He's got to anticipate this.
Yeah.
It's worse than a tracker organ. You know, there's a little bit of time delay in playing, say, a tracker organ as opposed to a electro-pneumatic. Well, a tracker organ is one where the action is mechanical, where the pipes are opened and closed by mechanical levers and pulleys, just like the bells are. But, of course, opening the valve on a pipe isn't quite like swinging a 200-pound hammer against the side of the bell. But the clappers are set usually so they're fairly close to the bell, and so that there isn't a great time lag. But yes, he does have to anticipate this. It's quite an art. This is the Riverside, or Tower in Riverside Church in New York. Some of you may have visited this. It's in the in Uptown New York, and it has the world's largest carillon. It was donated by the Rockefeller family. The carillon cast in England. Let's see, I think I have some data here on it. The largest bell in that in the Rockefeller carillon weighs 20 tons. That's a C2 bell. There are 74 bells covering 5 octaves. The world's second largest carillon is in Rockefeller Chapel in Chicago. The Rockefeller family had a particular fondness to bells, and that was also cast by the same bell founder and bell craftsman in England. However, the large Borden bell, the 20-ton Borden in the Riverside Carillon, is far from being the world's largest bell. Here's a picture taken up in the tower. There wasn't enough daylight really to see the very largest bells, or to get a good picture of those, but I took some of the smaller ones. You can see how carillon bells are hung up in the tower. They really, I think, they cover about 4 or 5 stories of the tower, with larger bells being at the bottom, smaller ones at the top. Well, here's the world's largest bell, the King Bell in the Kremlin in Russia, or else, and they have the world's largest everything in the Kremlin. The Tsar Kokel, as it's called, has never been rung, however. As you can see, there's a very large chunk missing from it. And that mishap occurred when it was being raised to be hung in the tower that the Tsar Ivan the Terrible, I guess, had built to house it. It was dropped. And that big piece weighing 7 ton, here's the piece itself, weighing 7 ton, broke out of it, and nobody else felt like melting it down and rehanging it. So the world's largest bell has never been rung. I believe the world's largest ringable bell is in St. Paul's in London. This is a carillon at a fairly recently built carillon on the campus of Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Notice the mountains right behind it. If any of you have been at BYU, it has to be one of the world's most beautiful university campuses. I was invited out here a couple years ago to speak or give the same talk, well, not the same one, but a similar talk at the dedication of this carillon. And then after the talk, they asked me if I wanted to go up in the cabin, and sure, I wanted to see it. This is the clavier. And they said, would you like to play it? And I said, I don't know how to play a carillon. Well, would you like to try it? Sure, why not? So that's the only carillon I've ever played. I don't remember if I played 3 notes or 4 or what. It's quite fun. But you see, these are the batons that the carillonier strikes. You can see his fist there. And you can see the levers and turnbuckles and things up above. From time to time, the carillonier will adjust those turnbuckles, you see, to bring the clapper over as close or as far from the bell as he wants, to adjust the action, in other words. This rather tragic sight is a picture actually from the magazine, but it was taken in Hamburg, Germany, right after World War II. Bells are usually cast from an alloy that is about 80-20 copper and zinc. And unfortunately, that's fairly close to the composition of cannon shells and rifle cartridges. And so church bells are often the victims of war machines, and World War II was certainly no exception. The Nazis systematically stripped many of the churches in Europe of their bells and melted them down for armament. Yeah, it's kind of a little bit funny in a way, the way they prepare for war in Europe. This has been true for the last several wars. When a war appears imminent, why they spend a lot of time and effort taking all the stained glass window out of the fine cathedrals and taking down a few of their finest bells and burying them. And after they get their stained glass windows and their art treasures and their bells safely underground, then they say, now we're ready to start shooting each other. And so a lot of the bells, fine bells in the Low Countries were saved, but a lot of them were lost. And apparently this particular picture was taken by one of the American military personnel in Germany right after the war. He came upon this scene and realized what its significance was, and got in touch with an acquaintance of his at the University of Michigan who was a bell expert, and told him about what they found. And this fellow, Professor Percival Price, came over to Germany and ended up taking a leave and spending a couple of years over there working with the Allied military authorities, helping to reclassify and get these bells back to their owners. But of course, many, many of them were lost. But some of the finest carillons really did survive World War II. Well, this is a different type of bell, a chime. It's called an orchestral bell, and it's used in orchestras to simulate the sound of bells. If you've ever heard an orchestra play something like Tchaikovsky's Overture 1812, chimes or tubular bells are used to simulate bell sounds. And so chimes are tuned to have partials that are somewhat the same as bells. And since I couldn't bring a bell here, a large church bell, oops, we'll skip over that, I brought along a chime because I wanted to illustrate what I think is a rather interesting subjective quality of the human ear. Last week I gave a full-blown talk on the perception of sound and music, but I'll give you a little bit of a sampling of it. The partials of a chime now are shown on this graph. This is similar to the one I showed for bells. The vertical axis is frequency in vibrations per second, or as we call them, hertz. The horizontal axis is the number of nodes along the pipe, along the chime pipe. And there are a dozen or so nodes plotted on this graph. But those two little colored blobs represent the frequency, or on the right-hand axis, the musical note name of the note that you hear. And you notice something rather curious about that, that there is no mode of vibration with the same frequency as the strike tone you hear. What you hear is an entirely subjective note. It's created in the air. Let me illustrate with the chime. Now, if I strike this, there's no ambiguity. You hear a good, strong, solid pitch, a bell-like quality. But if one analyzed this with a spectrum analyzer, you'd find that there was no mode of vibration at that frequency. To prove that, let me go through let me try to sound some of the individual frequencies separately. I've put little bits of tape on the chime here so that I can tell approximately where the note is, so that if I hold the chime firmly at that point, then I'll tend to excite that mode, the one that has a node there. Mode and node here. I've got to be careful of my articulation. All right, the lowest mode of vibration, where the thing vibrates as a whole, is quite low, and you won't hear that unless you're quite close to the chime. You can can hear it if you're close by, but it doesn't radiate very well. So we'll really start with mode 2, the second one up there. And here's mode 3. Mode 4. 5. 6. And 7. You notice the higher modes are sort of tuned harmonically. They sound like the notes in a major seventh chord. All right, the strike note we discovered after some study is really created by these three modes. It's an octave below this one. It's created by modes 4, 5, and 6. Let me sound modes 4, 5, and 6 for you so you can hear how they're tuned. They're tuned in a do-so-do sequence. All right, here's 4, 5, 6. And those three together, I can delete all the others. I can put those three on a tape and play them, and they give a subjective strike note. Let me again sound those three, and then I'll let you hear the strike note. You'll notice that it's an octave below mode 4. It's an octave below mode 4 at a pitch where there is no individual mode.
That's
The strike note of a tuned church bell is also determined subjectively by the ear, but there is a mode that's tuned to have the same frequency as the strike tone. But you could suppress that mode and you'd still hear the same strike tone. Well, I thought it's interesting because it shows how intricate, you know, one of the intricacies of the human auditory system. There are many things like this that acousticians become aware of what's going on up in this computer. Yeah, question?
No, just a comment.
Yeah.
A lot of people are just approved bell chimes, or wind chimes. They're making a lot of vacuum cleaner tubes, and where they strike in the different lengths you use for hanging on porches. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And conduit
pipes,
yeah. But they're really, quite pleasant to hear.
Yeah.
If you're not used to hearing the rumblings, they're better than clay bells.
Well, these are mode diagrams now for hand bells. We've made quite a few studies on hand bells in our acoustics laboratory. The mode diagrams for these hand bells are quite similar to those of church bells, but not exactly the same. For one thing, the handbell manufacturers usually don't tune more than two partials because handbells are somewhat higher in pitch, and so the ear is not as aware of the higher partials, although I've suggested to a number of handbell manufacturers that at least on their larger bells, they try to tune additional partials, but that makes the manufacture of them much more complicated. But the lowest two modes, which I've denoted here as the 2-0 and the 3-0, meaning they have no circular modes around the waist of the bell, are tuned a musician would say a major 12th apart, or a mathematician would say the frequencies are the first and third harmonics. The frequency of the 3-0 mode is three times the frequency of the 2-0. That's an octave plus a fifth. And then the higher modes, we can easily study them, we can easily isolate them, are usually not harmonically tuned. Well, as I say, we've done quite a bit of work on these bells in the laboratory. One of the techniques we've used for studying them is called holographic interferometry. Have any of you seen holograms? They're quite common now. Artists are getting very excited about holograms. In fact, there's a museum of holographic art in New York, down in Greenwich Village, that's devoted exclusively to this medium, and it's a very interesting place to visit. There's a smaller museum that's I know of that started in Chicago, and other cities may have museums that display and sell holographic art. Basically, what a hologram is a photographic plate on which you've stored information, not a photograph, but you've stored information that you would need to reconstruct the original image. If you look at a hologram, it just looks like a piece of dirty glass. There's no suggestion of a photographic image of it, and indeed there is no photographic image of it. It just looks like dirty glass. If you look at it under a microscope, you'll see a lot of little zigzags and whorls and lines that represent interference lines that have been recorded on this plate. Well, what we do is make a hologram of a bell while it's vibrating. And we do it in a certain way. It's a little more sophisticated than an ordinary hologram of a stationary object. We do it in such a way, we make a hologram interferogram, so that we see a profile of the parts of the bell that have moved. So the crown here, the red part at the top, is more or less stationary, or it's moved less than one unit, in this case about a quarter of the wavelength of light. And the other lines now each represent a locus of points that move the same amount. Well, the original hologram, then it can be used to reconstruct the bell image. And then we can, since that image has the properties of the original bell, we can take a photograph of it. So really what you're seeing here on the screen is a photograph of the reconstructed image from a hologram. Is that complicated enough? All right, but just forget all that now and enjoy the pictures, which show the symmetry of the various modes of vibration of a handbell. This is the fundamental mode. Remember where we had two meridian nodes that go across the top so that the bell vibrates in four segments. Now here's the next mode up where it vibrates in six segments. This is the 2-0 mode, again taken from the top of the bell. Now the amplitude of that mode has been increased enough so that the whole area that was showed red at the on the previous hologram now shows interference lines. So we can see how much the top vibrates. Here's a top view of the 3-0 mode. Here's, I believe this is a 3-1 mode. Three meridian lines and one global circle. There's a 4-1. I show them because I think they're good pop art.
They are.
Here's a side view of a bell, of a larger, much larger bell vibrating in the 3-1 mode. This is the 4-1 mode of a large bell. In fact, this is a G2 bell, which is kind of an experimental bell. It's the largest handbell I think ever made. It was made by Jacob Malta, owner of the Melmark Corporation. Some of you are more familiar with bells and know the Melmark name. And I think that Melmark now will sell you a G2 bell, but it's rather new on the market. Nobody had attempted to cast and tune a handbell as large. It's not one that you pick up and ring with a handle. It's you hang it and strike it with a soft mallet. Here's a one with three circular notes. The mode of vibration of this big bell. Well, this is a graph similar to the one I showed you with church bells that show you sort of a family history, I guess might be the best way to put it, of the modes of vibration of a small handbell. I think I won't go into this in great detail because I want to get on here to bell ringing and try to introduce you to this. So I'm going to skip over some of these slides. This one I guess one could entitle, How Not to Ring a Handbell. This is the way we actually study it in an anechoic laboratory. When you strike the bell, you excite all these ones. And so in order to excite one mode at a time to take pictures like you saw or to scan it with a microphone and study the modes, we drive it electromagnetically. We attach a very tiny coil, similar to a little miniature loudspeaker coil, to the bell and drive it at a single frequency so that we get a single mode of vibration excited. Well, here's a picture, I guess again a picture of a picture, of a ring of 12 bells in a, I think this is Buckfast Abbey in England. You notice that how they're hung, they're sort of in a circle around the largest bell, But the ringable bells are always hung on wheels like this so they can turn over. This is taken in the ringing tower at Church of the Advent in Boston, which is one of the few ringable sets of bells in North America. There are only 10 or 12 sets in North America. In fact, 90% or more of the ringable bells in the world are in British Isles. This was taken in Old North Church, also in Boston. This is where I learned to ring. The first bell society in Old North was actually founded by Paul Revere, who of course you associate with Old North because of his hanging lanterns in the belfry. But Paul Revere was one of the members of the original bell ringing society at Old North. And then the bells at Old North are the oldest set in North America, but for many, many years they weren't rung. The Old North Tower has been damaged in at least twice by hurricanes, and the last time it was repaired, the bracing was put up in such a way that it interfered with the ringing of the bells, so for many years they weren't rung. And then a group of engineers and physicists at MIT got interested in bell ringing and went over and looked at these and asked if they could change, modify the tower so the bells could be rung again, and got permission to do this. And so they, this MIT Ringing Society rings regularly over at Old North Church. Well, this is the way a bell is hung when it's going to be rung. As I mentioned earlier, there are really three ways you can sound the bell. You can swing the clapper against it, or you can swing the bell through a small arc. That's the way most church bells in this country are hung, so that you just swing it like a pendulum. You swing it over far enough so the clapper strikes the side and then swings back the other way, so you get a ding-dong on the two sides. But that way, you see, you have no control over the speed at which the bell rings. A bell of a given size will have a natural period, and it will always ring at that rate. So in order to do change ringing, you have to be able to control the moment at which the bell strikes. And the only way you can really do that is to turn the bell entirely over, full 360 degrees. Because then you can hold the bell at the top for a few seconds or for the required period and let it start to fall at a time, and then knowing how long it's going to be from the time you pull it off the top till it actually strikes, you can control the tempo of ringing. And those tapes you heard when you came in with all those intricate patterns were all run this way. The bell rope is attached to the side of the wheel, so it's not symmetrical, it's off-center. And so when the bell falls in one direction, we call that the hand stroke, the bell rope comes down a different length than it does when it goes off the other side and wraps three-quarters of the way around the wheel, which is called the backstroke. So there's two different strokes, the one at which you grab the end of the rope and the one at which you grab that woven piece of cloth that we call a salad. Let me back up and look at the bell ringing slide again. You notice that woven into the bell rope about 12, 15 feet from the end of it is the sally. So on alternate strokes, you're pulling off the sally, and then when the bell rings, that sally is carried right up through the hole in the ceiling, and then you grab the end of the bell for the other stroke. So it takes a bit of practice to learn how to control 3 or 4 or 5 tons of swinging bell metal up there and make it go ding exactly when you want it to go ding, and not when the bell thinks it ought to go ding. Yeah, here are two bells now set at backstroke and at handstroke. It looks the same, except that the rope in one case is wrapped one way around the wheel, and the other case it's wrapped the other way around the wheel. So that when you pull it off one way, it's going to turn one way, pull it off the other, it's going to turn the opposite direction. Okay, well, now let's get down to lesson zero in bell ringing. I hope so. Actually, handbells originated As a means, or handbells as we know them, I guess there have been handbells from antiquity, but handbells as we know them originated three centuries ago when English bell ringing societies decided they needed a way to practice without keeping the neighbors awake. And so they cast small bells and tuned them so that bell ringing societies could practice. So the change ringing that we'll attempt on handbells has some historical precedence. Well, the bells, instead of giving them notes on the staff now, are numbered 1 to 8. And of course, in true British fashion, they always do things backwards. You know, they drive on the left and so on. They mispronounce aluminium, and they also number the bells. Number 1 is the top bell, not the bottom one. Number 1 is the top bell, and number 8 is the bottom bell. So the top line now represents just a descending major scale. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you see. And then the other lines represent ways you can ring the bells. 16 changes, they're called, that will bring you back to this descending scale, which we call rounds. And this is just kind of a little kindergarten type exercise, just a little warm-up exercise. A real full-blown peal on the bells, by definition, requires at least 5,000 changes in succession. And the rules of change ringing are that you can only interchange adjacent bells. You look at that chart, you see line 2, you interchange each bell with its neighbor. 1 changed with 2, 3 changed with 4, 5 changed with 6, 7 changed with 8. And then in the next line, if you've just done that again, why, you'd be back to rounds. So in order to prevent that, you kept the first and the last bells the same and changed all the inner bell. And elaborate methods have been devised for going through changes like this without ever repeating a sequence. With 8 bells, I think there are something like 40,000 changes possible without repeating. With 10 bells, it goes up to 700,000. But by definition, a peal is 5,000 changes. And that's kind of the target goal of every English bell ringing society, is to ring a peal in different these different methods. And if you, in fact, develop a new method that nobody has ever recorded and registered in the Guild of Bell Ringers in Cambridge, well, then you can name it and have it recorded in the Cambridge Book of Changes. So the Cambridge Book of Changes is like Webster's Dictionary, but it's all numbers, each of these different methods. Have any of you read the Dorothy Sayers Mystery of the Nine Tailors? There's a couple of copies over here in the library. That mystery, Dorothy Sayers has always been very popular out at Holden. There are a lot of Holdenites here that have read everything she ever wrote. And one of her mysteries, The Nine Tailors, is built around change ringing. The hero detective Lord Peter Wimsley solves the murder mystery by his knowledge of change ringing. And that novel was on Masterpiece Theater about 4 years ago, something like that. And a lot of people got introduced to change ringing by watching that series on Masterpiece Theater. But if you enjoy mysteries, I think you'll especially enjoy this one now after hearing a little bit about bells. Well, are you ready to give bell ringing a trial? Maybe I should ask first if there are any questions, and then we'll form a little circle here and try our hand at bell ringing. Yeah. Our hand bells? It depends upon the size. The basic, you see, most handbell ringing in the United States is choral ringing. You no doubt heard handbell choirs at churches. They're becoming very popular. It's a beautiful musical instrument, and a fine way for people who can't sing to be in a choir. And for people who can sing. I think a 2-octave set of tuned bells is that, now that's a two-octave chromatic set, so that you can ring in any key. It's somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000. It keeps going up as the price of bronze goes up. An individual bell will be anywhere from $40 to $100, depending upon the size of it. So they're, compare. You have to think of them as musical instruments. They're not. But a lot of churches now have bell choirs. I think it's a very fine addition to the musical equipment in a church, because anyone can learn to ring bells, whether you are a musician. If you're a musician, you probably learn a little faster, but anyone can learn.
Are the larger size bells of a different tone? Are they higher or lower? I have seen
the larger ones are lower.
Ones are lower.
Yeah. They're scaled so that the shapes are fairly similar, but the larger ones are tuned to a lower pitch. Well, let's see. How should we do this? Let's form a ring here. I'll ask. We'll do something that the British would never do.
Here is an American handbell choir playing "Christ the Lord is Risen Today." The Loughborough Carillon, a Dutch tune played by Mr. W.E. Jordan. Bow bells, call changes on the old ring. Bow bells again, this time Grand Succinct's on the new 12.